I only know it because I happened to meet you earlier. Good afternoon. It's good to see you all here today. You certainly are a biased sample, those who hang around for the last presentation of the last day for APHA. In this case, I'm glad to have a biased sample. It probably means you're more motivated. What I'd like to be talking about today is the relationship between sexual orientation and gender identity and substance abuse. And specifically, we're going to be talking about whether or not research that's conducted in this area, general substance abuse research, tends to include sexual orientation and gender identity as relevant variables. My co-author, and actually the main author of this study, who wasn't able to be here, is Anissa Santa. I'm not sure why her name is overlapping with the word databases. That wasn't happening. Oh well, but it is. So she's unable to be here, and I want to acknowledge her work in this area. In terms of disclosures, somehow I've managed to avoid all the lucrative financial offers that we get as people who study LGBT issues. So what I'd like to talk about a little bit here, this is certainly similar to the results that other people have presented already today. Certainly there's an increasing interest in the role of sexual orientation and gender identity in terms of substance abuse and dependency. What I want to highlight in talking about this is some of the inherent difficulties in doing this area of work. So we know, for example, that rates of substance use appear to be higher in the LGB population than in the general population. This would be indicated by lower rates of abstainers, for example, from either drugs or alcohol. We also know that there are higher rates of problematic use in LGB populations. A number of different studies are contributing information regarding that, and there's some differences within the LGB and LGBT population that are beginning to emerge in terms of our research. What is a problem with these and other studies is that whenever we're recruiting based on sexual orientation into a research study, you're relying on self-report. You're relying on people to self-report a potentially stigmatizing variable. So there's a lot of inherent problems and the possibility that you would get a biased sample in doing this type of work. However, we do know that sexual orientation and gender identity are important variables that should be assessed in general research, much as demographic information is collected of participants in research studies. And reporting this as demographic information would allow for other research analysis. And of course, we could see how many different studies could stem off of research in this area if we were able to ascertain who in certain samples identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. In terms of a little bit more background, we do know that sexual orientation and gender identity are considered important variables by researchers. There's a lot of research in this area to identify that. However, in 2001, only one state treatment database was querying sexual orientation. I benefited from that querying of sexual orientation by living in Washington State and conducting my dissertation data using these using the state treatment database, which was quite beneficial in terms of being able to look at people who identify as LGB versus those who identify as heterosexual. It's unknown to what extent these variables are identified in the substance abuse literature generally, so that's what we sought to determine in this particular study. So we have two major research questions. The first one, are sexual orientation and gender identity being reported in the current substance abuse literature? And the second, are sexual orientation or gender identity being queried in state treatment databases? I'll talk about these both mini-surveys in turn. The first one involved a scanning of the PsycINFO database. So PsycINFO, of course many of you know, reports and culls information from a number of different published sources and is a good searchable database for identifying new and relevant literature. We searched for studies with the following parameters. First of all, they had to be empirical articles, so we excluded any sort of meta-analysis, or we excluded studies that did not have an empirical component, like book chapters. They had to be published in the year 2007, so we're looking at recent research. They had to be in peer-reviewed journals, and the keywords that we used for searching for these were substance abuse. 559 studies met these inclusion criteria. We randomly selected 200 using the random select feature in SPSS. And then we had to whittle that down a little bit. There were 29 studies that were dropped from the analysis, six due to not only not being in English, but being difficult to find a translator who could translate them because the languages were somewhat difficult to ascertain. There were 23 studies that were excluded due to lack of relevance. This would include things such as animal research studies or things where sexual orientation or gender identity would not be salient variables. In terms of our results, so we looked through these different studies, looked at all of the participant section to determine how many of these studies did query about these key variables. Only six of these studies reported sexual orientation of their participants, so that's 3.5%. And we found that none of the studies, none of those nearly 200 studies, reported gender identity other than binary. So male and female were the only demographic variables reported in terms of gender options. We did find that 55, or about 32% of these studies, did report marital status, and of those, 14 offered an option for non-married partnerships. Of course, this doesn't necessarily mean they're same-sex partnerships. They could be heterosexual partnerships or common law spousal arrangements, for example. So of the six studies that did report sexual orientation, two reported the sexual orientation of treatment samples. And within these two samples, sexual minorities comprise fairly large percentages, somewhat larger than the rates of sexual minorities that are presumed to exist in the general population, 15% and 16.8% respectively, indicating, of course, that if you do query about sexual orientation, it's possible that you would identify an important subsample in your study. One study indicated they included only heterosexual couples, so that did report sexual orientation, of course, but was only reporting people and only querying people who were heterosexual. Two studies included only sexual minorities, so the focus of those studies was on sexual minority individuals, and then one study was examining HIV outreach programs. So we summed up the sample size for these different six studies, and the total number of sexual minorities in these studies was 1,163. So if we look at the total sample size of all of these 200 studies, however, that's 706,000. So this represents less than 1% of all the participants from the studies. We might imagine that if and rates of LGBT identity vary somewhat. I think Aaron had used 2.5% in terms of talking about his study. That would be around 17,000 people. So we're clearly only getting a small fraction of people who might be actually identifying as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender because it's not being queried about. The consequences of this is, of course, presumed heterosexuality. Most of these people might have, if they had the opportunity to identify, would have identified as sexual minorities, thereby enabling us to do further analyses. So our other kind of mini study, study two, this refers to state treatment databases. So all states collect data of people going through substance abuse treatment because of the variety of federal and state funding that is contributed towards these sorts of programs. These wonderful databases allow states to make decisions based on what programs seem to be working. They inform us about what the general outcome is of individuals in substance abuse treatment. So we decided that what we would do is to look for the 50 states to see whether or not these state treatment databases collect information on sexual orientation, and if they ask about gender identities other than simply male or female. We telephoned the administrators of these different databases at least three times before we classified them as non-responders. And we asked the administrators, as I mentioned before, if their state collected information on sexual orientation and if there were gender response options beyond male or female. So a very simple study, just like the previous one. What we found out is that we were able to contact 35 of the 50 states. So even after three attempts, we weren't able to get this information from 15 states, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. Sadly enough, the state that was collecting data a few years ago is still the only state collecting information on both sexual orientation and gender identity. We did find that six states did allow for response options other than male and female for gender. So that would mean, of course, if you are a resident of one of those six states and you identify as transgender, you might have an option on this survey as opposed to the other 44 states. people haven't seen enough maps of the United States with colored states this election season, so I thought I'd put one up. Basically, this just indicates that Washington State clearly is the only state where the treatment database collects information on sexual orientation and gender identity. The six states that do allow for non-binary options in terms of gender identity might be surprising to you. I think it's interesting to note. And then, of course, the states that are in white are the ones that we were not able to contact despite three different calls to them. So to summarize from these relatively simple and straightforward studies, sexual orientation seems to be rarely reported in the substance abuse literature, leaving us with the current state wherein it's difficult to advance our understanding of the relationship between sexual orientation and substance abuse. Two of the studies that did report sexual orientation did have treatment samples with a significant proportion of sexual minorities, indicating that it would be valuable and worth researchers' time to collect these data. Gender identity even has less presence in the substance abuse literature. It seems that very few studies, none in our case, gave any information about people who identified other than male or female. And in terms of state databases, very few states are collecting these data. Reporting sexual orientation and gender identity in the literature could clearly increase our knowledge about the relationship between sexual orientation and substance abuse. And then in state treatment databases, researchers could use this information for secondary data analyses. One of the benefits of those sorts of analyses are that since people are not recruited into the study on the basis of self-identification or on any sort of potential bias sampling methods trying to recruit LGBT populations, this might be a better way of being able to ascertain prevalence rates within the general population and to determine the outcomes of people in treatment. The recommendations that clearly follow from this are if you or other people are collecting data based on substance abuse, to query and report sexual orientation and gender identity should be standard practice. States also need to be encouraged to add gender identity and sexual orientation to their treatment databases. In terms of limitations of this study, so we looked at existing literature. It's possible that these researchers did inquire about sexual orientation and didn't report it, or perhaps they gave options for gender identity other than male or female and simply didn't have any participants who identified in those categories. So we may be missing some of the best efforts of researchers to collect these data simply based on what they had published. The studies that were sampled were really within the psychological literature, although PsychInfo does pull from a variety of different disciplines. Similar studies looking at data pulled from other databases could be useful as well. And then some of our treatment database administrators did not respond to our queries, so we weren't able to report data on all of the 50 states. I'd like to acknowledge the variety of undergraduate students who have worked on this project, in addition to Anissa, who is the primary person on this study. Thank you. I see a question. Yes?
So, given those results, are you going to try to do something to get these states to put a question on their data set?
I thought I might be asked that question. Well, I think it certainly would be the next step. We've just collected these data quite recently, and I do think that that would be the logical next step to try to encourage states to do so, starting with my own home state of Montana, which is not collecting these information. So I think that is certainly part of the next role. Whether or not they'll listen to someone who is a researcher encouraging them to do that, and the perceived barriers are kind of interesting. That might be something I'd collect data on, too. It's amazing that people think it's somewhat potentially stigmatizing or embarrassing to ask people about sexual orientation or to give gender identity options other than male or female. Overcoming those hurdles is an important next step.
Well, maybe the CHIS people could help you with that.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, if you contacted them, they may be able to help you with that.
Great.
That's something they do.
Excellent. Thank you. Helpful. Any other questions?
Thanks, Brian. Our next presentation is Understanding Changing Relationships Between Substance Use and Sexual Risk Behavior Among MSM in Chicago, 1997 versus 2003. The co-author is Michael Fendrich. He will be the presenter today. The other co-authors are Mary Ellen Makasi Amiti and Timothy Johnson.
Okay, thank you. So I am the second to last presenter of this conference. Okay, here we go. All right, so bear with me.